Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us at commonwealthclub.org, on our Facebook page, and on Twitter at CW Club. I'm Robert Rosenthal, the Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting and the moderator for today's program. Our guest is Chuck Lewis, an investigative reporter and the founder of the Center for Public Integrity. During his nearly 40-year career now, Chuck has been an investigative journalist for ABC News and a producer for CBS's News 60 Minutes. He is currently a tenured professor at American University School of Communications. He has written for several major publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times. And he doesn't have enough room in his house for all the National Journalism Awards he's won. Mr. Lewis's new book, 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity, discusses the increasingly blurry lines between the truth and spin in the news. What you also read in Chuck's book is you really get a history of deceit in one way or disinformation, going back to really the Gulf of Tonkin, the Pentagon Papers, up till current events recently. It's really an eye-opener, and Chuck has had a ringside seat and is one of the most credible and respected journalists in the country, and his work really stands out because he really goes deep on information. He believes that this process of information and disinformation that comes out of Washington mainly, and really at all levels of government, leads to a less informed American citizenry. The book really reveals the many ways in which truth can be distorted by groups and individuals wielding power, including those in our local, state, and national halls of government. So let's welcome Chuck Lewis, and I'm sure we're going to have a very lively presentation and conversation. Thank you.
Very nice introduction. Thank you. And it's a treat to be here. I've never spoken here before, but I've always understood the importance of this institution. And I like it even more because I heard what your founder said once. We only propose to find the truth and set it loose in the world. Seems like a good objective. So anyway, this has been a strange journey, I guess. That's a common refrain maybe for authors, but this book took 9 years and three manuscripts and two publishers, and it was my first solo book. I did five with other folks, the Buying of the President series at the Center for Public Integrity and others, and what happened is at the end of, I guess they're coming here, no, I'm just kidding. After 2004, I stepped down from the Center for Public Integrity, which I started from my house, and at some point the founder has to leave the building, and I decided that I knew I wanted to probably do a book, but I wasn't quite sure, and then as I started to realize, a year after we were informed, even by the President of the United States himself, that they had not found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, I noticed that 60% of the American people still thought they were there. And in fact, I later learned that as of 2012, 62% of Republicans still believed that WMD was in Iraq. And I was it's hard to astonish an investigative reporter, but I was a little surprised, and actually it hit me kind of hard because I thought, two things. Well, one is the obvious point. If information doesn't matter, the whole notion of self-governance and a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, all those wonderful things that we all studied in school and we all believe in when we walk up the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, suddenly information maybe is not as important as we thought, maybe. But the other thing was even more personal. I had devoted decades of my life, as Rosie has, to trying to find information and truth, and if it doesn't matter anymore, well, I guess you could say there might be a little soul searching about your occupation, like, why am I here then? If only some people are interested in this, as opposed to, oh yeah, the public. All my friends could happily refrain along with this. I have a habit of being somewhat overly thorough, probably to a fault, also known as anal retentive. And I felt obligated I had always, most investigative reporters I know, the cliche is watch what they do, not what they say, those in power. Because the actions always do kind of speak louder than words. People can say anything, but what did they do? So you concentrate on that. But then I realized in this instance, I had ignored the words and I had ignored the communication part of leadership and a country, and in this case, the U.S. So I decided I had to really, for the first time in decades, focus. I always tried to avoid public relations people. I hope I don't offend if any of you work in that business. But I sort of felt that it was time. Maybe I had not paid sufficient attention to how information is created and disseminated. So I put together 8 or 9 researchers, and we literally tracked what we wanted to see was every false and erroneous statement by the President of the United States and 7 other top officials. And to not just see who said what, when, and we did do that, but we also wanted to know when it spiked up at certain, did all the comments occur in one period of time? We wanted to gauge exactly all of those details. And we noticed in a peculiar way that no one had actually done it. I may sound, well, what other idiot would do that? No, but I felt it was necessary to observe it. I had to understand the extent of it. And so we put out a report. I had left the center, but I gave it to the center on the 5-year anniversary of the invasion, U.S. invasion of Iraq. And I wanted to see what we essentially called it was the Iraq the War Card was the name of the report, but it had documented 935 false and erroneous statements, and it showed that they had spiked up at precisely key strategic moments that, with no question about it, it was orchestrated very carefully. I sort of suspected. We did a 380,000-word searchable chronology. It made massive news around the world. The New York Times had it, and then AP, well, everyone, AP, BBC, 3 stories, NPR, you name it, everyone covered it. The White House denounced it within hours, of course, and all of that's discussed in the book. But the book is actually not about Iraq, but being anal retentive, I then thought, well, okay, that's Iraq, but is this an aberration? I mean, is it always like this? I mean, I know that politicians frequently are not all that truthful, but I didn't know. Then I'm thinking, well, maybe I need to go back and ponder what else is going on. So I felt the need to then, in fact, I was so bothered by it all, I had to interview the great journalists, the iconic journalists, the ones that we celebrate, the Woodwards, the Bernsteins, the Cy Hirsches, all those people. When they got it right, who were they? Who were those people? And, of course, I didn't just want to interview them with a tape recorder. It had to be with high-def video, George Lucas's high-def video, extremely expensive. And so I did 100 hours with 25 leading journalists from 1950, the guy who did the reporting that brought down Senator Joseph McCarthy, all the way through civil rights, Watergate, Vietnam, up to post. And so then I had a sense of when the journalists got it right, you know, the moments that we celebrate, we kind of generally regard were important, and they even changed history, perhaps. But then I wanted to see other key moments where they either were notorious or had been written about, or I already suspected, but mostly they'd already been written about, notable deceptions that had been written about over time. So in other words, was Iraq, that whole instance, an aberration, or had it occurred before? And so what I found was, and the my favorite part of the book, which may not be a useful thing for me to say up here, but my favorite part happens to be the appendix. That would be naturally what you would expect from someone like me. But the appendix has real-time truth, the 10 instances that I think are what I call the most mortally consequential, cause the greatest loss of life, when by officialdom in the U.S. government, going back 50 to 70 years, and then similarly with corporations. And, of course, the main point of what I found, or I didn't know it was, I mean, I had suspected it, but I didn't know, was deception like what had occurred with Iraq actually happens frequently. And then, of course, I studied really closely, as others many before me have studied, the Pentagon Papers and the Vietnam War. As you probably know, well, we all know, we went to war in Vietnam, and it all started with in the 6 days from the time we said we were attacked to the Senate and the House passing a war resolution regarding the Gulf of Tonkin, which became the war declaration for the entire Vietnam War. That all jammed through Congress in 6 days. We actually did not find out the truth about Vietnam until 1971 with the Pentagon Papers, when we learned that we had been violating the land, water, and airspace of North Vietnam for weeks prior to the Gulf of Tonkin attack. And in fact, the second so-called big attack, there was no attack. There was no enemy actually out there. As Ben Bradley once said, you know, wouldn't it have been nice to have known the truth in 64, not 71? But then I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. So we have two wars, 40 years apart. One's a Democratic president, one's a Republican president. In both cases, the public was bamboozled. And, oh, by the way, thousands of people died in a war that was basically sold on false pretenses. And then I was like, you know, then it was getting really interesting, I have to say. So then the one for corporations that is most took me aback the most, just when I thought I couldn't be, was I always knew, of course, I had investigated the tobacco industry myself. But I did not realize, and of course, you're probably well aware, 100 million people in the world died from smoking-related illnesses in the 20th century. In this century, the World Health Organization says 1 billion people. What you may not know is the U.S. government, from the Carter administration all the way up to the Obama administration, has exported tobacco and changed the trade laws to enable the export of the sale of tobacco around the world. In other words, we are complicit in the export of tobacco from growing and consumption and children using it and advertising everything all over the world. It started here and we promoted it. And so all that was in it regarding tobacco. But I have 9 other companies that also over a period of decades, deceived the public. And again, the public took that long to figure out what occurred. And there is a key chapter actually about the subject of tobacco, where journalists were, what can I say? They didn't tell it. They didn't tell the story. They didn't tell the truth. They basically punted on telling it. And from 1938, the first study about smoking causing cancer, there's a famous journalist I'm sure many of you have heard of, George Seldes, who had a newsletter called In Fact, which was the precursor to I.F. Stone's newsletter in some ways. In fact, I.F. Stone was given the mailing list of Seldes. What upset the veteran reporter Seldes was when the finding came out about smoking in 1938, no one reported it. Associated Press moved it on the wires, and hardly any newspapers in America picked it up. Why? Well, they're all getting ads in their papers for tobacco, partly is one of the reasons. So I go from basically 1938, 1940, all the way up to 2000, and I have, I don't know, 6 or 8 examples of reporters, or their news organizations more accurately, declining to actually talk about this subject of the health issues of tobacco. And in the book, I have my own story. I did a tobacco story, and the owner of CBS, who also happened to own a tobacco company, asked Mike Wallace, the guy I was producing for, not to do the story. This is 8 years before Lowell Bergman's Insider story. We all know what happened there. Many of us do. And Mike and Don Hewitt, the founder of 60 Minutes at that time, were very angry with Tisch. He had laid off 450 people. That'll do it, I guess. And so they had become disillusioned with the new owner who succeeded William Paley. Wallace told him, go to hell, and we aired it, and we said on the air that Lawrence Tisch, the president of CBS News and the president of Lorillard, which is one of the tobacco companies, declined to comment. There is a funny story. I don't know if I guess I'm in it now. I should probably tell that. So fast forward several months, so it actually aired. That's one where it's surprising it aired, and I was surprised too. I had a co-producer, Rich Bone, and the two of us were excited. Holy, they really did it. We thought for sure we were going to get spiked. And we're at the Tavern on the Green celebrating the 20th anniversary of 60 Minutes. So this is 1988. And they have a big ice sculpture with a big six and a big O and all these fancy people that I don't generally mingle with, you know, the corporate types. I don't get out much. And anyway, I see Mike Wallace is there, and he's got a twinkle in his eye, which he was wont to do. We had our differences, which we'll get to, but he was had an impish quality where almost like an adolescent sometimes, which was actually made him likable in that sense. But he saw Tish a few feet away. And I apologize for the language I'm going to say here, but I'm just quoting verbatim. But it wouldn't read well if I beeped it or something, so I'm just going to say it. So he sees Tish, and he says, and I'm there, and he says, "Hey, Larry, come here. There's somebody I'd like you to meet." And I look at Mike like, "I can't believe you're doing it." I mean, I'm not saying anything. I'm just like, so I know he's going to do something that will be embarrassing to all concerned. And so Tish comes over, and I had never met him, of course. And so we shook hands, and he said, "Yeah, Larry, this is Charles Lewis. He's the guy that shoved that tobacco story right up your ass." And so I said, "Hello. You know, what are you going to say? I mean," so anyway, but, you know, I also have producers, and we have a panel at the Investigative Reporters and Editors Conference here in town. 1,500 journalists from around the U.S. and the world are in town about investigative reporting. And ABC News killed two tobacco documentaries in the same period of time, and part of that story was never told. And I went through the archival records of ABC News, including Rune Arledge's papers, and I was able to confirm what everyone always suspected. When ABC wanted to sell the company, and they didn't want an outstanding liability, they needed a clean balance sheet. ABC Corporate, when they had a $10 billion Philip Morris lawsuit against Walt Bogdanich and other reporters, they had another documentary that was even possibly harder hitting that was shot on four continents about the export of tobacco around the world. They killed that documentary within 3 hours of the Philip Morris news conference announcing it. And they never admitted it. To this day, they haven't admitted officially as a corporation. But the fact is that decision was made in that meeting. And it had already been approved for air. They were going to air this thing in a couple of weeks. But that day, no, we're not airing that. And so this book has those kinds of internal revelations, but it also has a macro view of our inability as a people to know what the truth is in real time, which is really a key part, I think, of the book. So the back end of the book gets into the future. There is a chapter on the future of truth and what is happening. There are several things happening. One other gloomy thing I have to tell you, I'm sure you know, 30% of all commercial print journalists lost their job in the last 15 or 20 years. We have the same number of reporters, so-called print, you know, traditional digital print reporters. We have the same number today as 1972, the year of Watergate. The problem is we've added 100 million people, and the budget of the federal government has gone up 18 times. Most cities have half as many professional journalists in their cities. The good news, if there is any good news, a little bit of good news, is that there is a nonprofit journalism ecosystem that was started by Rosie's group, the Center for Investigative Reporting, four co-founders back in 1977. I started the Center for Public Integrity in 89. Today there are between 95 and 100 nonprofit newsrooms that have sprouted up, most of them founded by rank-and-file investigative reporters or editors, but not publishers. I mean, just regular journalists who are actually trying to find the truth, have started these throughout the United States. Now, it is only a fraction of what has been lost. No one has any illusions. I don't. But on the other hand, we have a long tradition in this country of nonprofit journalism. See Associated Press, see the Christian Science Monitor, see National Public Radio, the only news organization that doubled its audience after 9/11 in America over a 10-year period. So there are signs, and there's other things I talk about which I'll spare you, but there's some wild and crazy potential ideas of ways to enlarge the public space, which is really what I want to do most. I now am, as you heard, a professor at American University, but I have an investigative reporting workshop, which is a university-based reporting center. Lowell Bergman, who I worked with 30 years ago, two networks. Lowell, as you probably know, has an investigative reporting program at the University of California, Berkeley, and his and my workshop are the two largest out of 18 reporting centers in the United States, nonprofit, and we all partner. We've done five co-productions with Frontline, a Showtime, Climate Change, Years of Living Dangerously, some of you may have seen, and we did an hour for that, and we incubated a couple books, and we've had 75 students, seven professors, and 10 or 15 outside writers produce 60 investigative stories in 5 years. So there are things happening. We're making sure that it doesn't become hieroglyphics and that young people will know how to do this work, including all the new ways with technologies that are emanating mostly from this general area of the world. And so with that, I will stop and we'll talk. I maybe talked too long already. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Chuck. We're now going to have a Q&A, and thank you from the audience for the questions. There's a quote in your book from Paul Starr, who's a Princeton professor. He says that corruption flourishes where journalism does not. The less news coverage, the more entrenched political leaders become, and the more likely they are to abuse power. So you started talking about the solution, but can you talk a little bit about, because I think the average person doesn't understand what it takes to do investigative reporting, the amount of time, the commitment, the risks, and you're outlining, but talk about why it's really crucial in a democracy and how you think people need to learn more about that. Or do you think the public understands that?
I don't. I
hope this is working.
I don't think the public generally understands it. Yes, it's a problem. First of all, investigative reporting takes time and costs money. When I ran the Center for Public Integrity, we never had an investigation. It was less than a month, and one of them went 4 years, and the reporter went to 44 states personally because the records weren't online. But digging records out and reading, reading what you need to read and interviewing, one book we interviewed 1,200 people, the buying of the Congress, and we had 36 researchers, writers, editors doing a big epic look at Congress. That work is really important. It finds out shocking things like no food safety bills before Congress in 10 years, and the ag committees, agriculture committees in both houses of Congress were getting massive amounts of money not to improve food inspections in America by, of course, the agribusiness industries. And so would we know that without digging through the legislative votes and the committee votes as well as the floor votes and also looking at the lobbying by the industry and also looking at the revolving door of the congressional aides who then go to work for this company or that? Does anyone look at that normally, most citizens? The answer is no. Do the members of Congress put press releases out about their entanglements? Of course not. Are they in the ads? No. And so I think we can all point to each of our organizations, things that change, laws that change because of our reporting. I agree. I know Paul Starr, and he's won two Pulitzer Prizes for his scholarly work at Princeton. It is true. I've tracked corruption around the world, and I started a group with two others called Global Integrity that tracks documents and information transparency and corruption issues around the world. They've now looked at 100 countries. Corruption does flourish in the dark. And when there's the old cliche, but it's a famous quote by Louis Brandeis, that sunlight is the best disinfectant. I happen to believe that, and people have believed it for a century, and generally that's true. But sometimes one article is not even enough. You have to, like, these days the attention span is so short, maybe less than a hummingbird's, that, you know, getting the public to focus, unfortunately a story has to appear several days, and it has to be you have to almost have a thematic thing that you show. Otherwise, it falls into the ether. So the public's attention span has become an issue. Sound bites 25 years ago were 30 or 40 seconds. Now they're 6 or 8 seconds. What can you say of any significance in 6 to 8 seconds? I've been interviewed by network correspondents. I basically became something resembling a talking head because I always said things were outrageous, and our office was 2 blocks from the White House, and so they would always come over, and I was told, please don't use 3-syllable words. Could you say that again with 2 syllables and make it shorter? And, you know, that kind of stuff gets on my nerves, it's fair to say. So, yeah, there's a problem here, but does this stuff matter, and have I seen laws change? Yes. The Center investigated corruption in 50 state capitals about part-time legislators. 40 out of 50 states have part-time legislators. Well, you can imagine the potential for conflicts of interest. If they have a day job, what is their main concern in the legislature? Is it possible it is their job? There are some industries that encourage their people to become state legislators. Forget the lobbying. Just go in there and do your thing. So we did a big report nationwide, 45 news organizations, 45 states participating. No one had looked at the data. And we found hundreds of conflicts of interest, and 20 to 25 states changed their laws on transparency within about 2 months. So does information affect those in power? It does. They worry about how they're perceived.
How long did it take to do that, and what was the cost?
Well, that was a big project. I had 3 or 4 reporters, and we worked on it, actually more like 5 or 6, for about 2.5 years. And, you know, there have been other iterations of it, but the first one was back in 99 and 2000.
So that may have cost close to $1 million when you're all in on everything or more?
They were pretty young. It might have been a little less. But I'm just kidding.
Well, the point of that question.
I know what you're saying. Yes, it was expensive.
And this is one of the issues today with how you support and fund investigative reporting because corporate media has walked away from it. So Chuck has been in the forefront of creating the nonprofit journalism movement. I'm trying to assimilate a bunch of these questions, big one is really about the issue of how you sustain this kind of work. And how do you educate the American public? And in your book, you mentioned idiot culture, which is something I guess Carl Bernstein coined. But it's really the bigger question is, with all the glut of information, how do you surface this? And if you've thought about how to make this more accessible, but also, we'll use the word, have more impact. So I'm making a statement, but the question really is about the idiot culture that sort of exists today and how you get the kind of information you create into the broader ethos.
Well, I mean, I know it's an issue we both grapple with. It's really hard. I worked with Carl Bernstein for a year. He was the bureau chief at ABC News after the Washington Post, and he made the comment. He wrote an article for the New Republic that called Triumph of the Idiot Culture. And you might think that he wrote that last week because it certainly might still be applied, but he wrote it in 1992. And it was that year that Nelson Mandela, the same week, the same few day period, I believe you had the Rwanda genocide, and you separately had Nelson Mandela coming out of prison after 28 years in South Africa.
It was actually the fall of the change in Europe.
And by the way, the Soviet Union collapsed. It was kind of a heavy news period. The lead story for ABC News was Diane Sawyer trying to do an interview, I think, with Ivana Trump in New York City. It drove Carl up the wall, and so he wrote that article. And when I interviewed him about 4 or 5 years ago about that article, he said, well, obviously it's much worse now. And that was 92. But, I mean, that's the problem. So getting the public's attention span is really extremely difficult. And the work does cost money. I mean, when I started the center from my house, I had never managed money. I had never run anything. I had never raised money. But this would appear to be doomed from the start. I figured out that if I didn't do something fast, I would there's no telling where I'd end up. So anyway, I did end up raising over the years tens of millions of dollars. You find a way. There are people that may not be deep into journalism, but they do care about the country and they do care about the state of democracy and certain values and principles that they are offended by when they don't see them upheld. And you can do that in a way where you disclose your source of income. I think that's relevant. It's transparent. It needs to be. And you have to have standards. I know that sounds, of course you have to have standards, but I mean, you should have standards about what money you will accept and not accept. There are people that sometimes want to give you money for not always terrific reasons. So you learn all that. You develop scar tissue. But is it possible to do this? The answer to that is yes. And what's so interesting about the new ecosystem is a lot of the folks are a little bit like me. They don't have an MBA. They didn't aspire to run anything. You know what I mean? And they're now doing it. So I'm not saying this is a panacea or that's perfect, but there's all kinds of possibilities. Right now I'm at a university. Well, guess what? Universities have brilliant people, and the space for op-eds is so small they can't be heard anymore, but they all write books. They try to write op-eds. They have blogs. And they do deep research with, oh, by the way, data that's actually founded on real stuff, you know, documents. We have a fellow who's tracking a story, a public anthropologist, has done extraordinary research all over planet Earth, and we're going to partner with him, and I'm trying to open it up and have a whole new field called accountability studies that is everything from human rights law to political science, tracking corruption to forensic accounting, to all these skills, and then let whoever these young people are going to work, they're going to do something for the world because they think it needs help. And that, to me, is a movement almost. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. It's great. Now, if they're actual journalists, that's fantastic. Do they have to go precisely into journalism? No. I mean, the fact is the space needs to broaden and widen. I wrote an article for Oxford University last fall called Rise of the NGOs. The best investigative reporting on planet Earth today, not the New York Times. Does anyone know where it is? It's Human Rights Watch. They have 400 people. 100 or 200 of them are former journalists. Former. They're still being journalists, but we don't call them that now. And they have 19 offices on planet Earth, and they cover it intensely. Do they have a point of view? Yes. They think human rights are a good thing. And obviously, that's glib. I know that there are issues in the Middle East where they have internal strife over certain subjects, but they are doing the most thorough look at that subject. And so now you're getting experts and talented folks and data sets that can be exchanged. So I see all kinds of hope here for widening this space. We jointly hired a Pulitzer Prize winner at my workshop with the Washington Post. Guess what? It was a Washington Post idea. They called me. They said, we heard you were trying to hire this guy. And I said, I heard you were trying to hire him. And I said, well, I don't have enough money. And they said, neither do we. So we did a memorandum of understanding. We have hired him for a three-year MOU, and he's working on the investigative team of the Post. He's a senior editor, me, and he's on the faculty. And did I mention he's teaching grad students inside the newsroom of the Washington Post? Has that ever been done in this country? I actually don't think so. Not at that metro level, the paper that's received the second highest number of Pulitzer Prizes. That's sort of... They would never have imagined doing that 5 years ago. It would have been unthinkable. Now they're doing it. So keep watching. Things are getting interesting. That's the way I look at it.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program. And we're talking with Charles Lewis, one of the best investigative reporters in the country over the last 40 years, and the founder of the Center for Public Integrity. I'm Robert Rosenthal, the executive director of the Center for Investigative Reporting, and your moderator. You can hear the Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and also see video of the programs online on our YouTube channel. So one of the things that's striking about Chuck, and obviously is coming through here, is his passion and commitment. And journalists are unique. They don't start in journalism to become wealthy. It's not a profession you gain a lot of money. You don't get paid a lot for it. But they're very passionate, as you can hear. So, Chuck, you had an experience as a young man that I think may have shaped your entire career. I think you were 21, and you interviewed Orlando Letelier. And can you tell us about that story and how you met him and a little bit about what you've later discovered about his death and who he was.
Yeah, that was a pretty seminal moment. I was a political science major at the University of Delaware. I'm from Delaware. There's a couple other people from there. You know, it's the other side of the continent. And I wasn't thinking journalism, although I did work at the Wilmington News Journal in the sports department, but I wasn't sure I wanted to be a sports writer the rest of my life. I love sports, but so I did a senior thesis on, I was surprised at what had happened, and all investigative reporters are an idealist without illusions, the line that Kennedy said about himself. I happen to think that's, most investigative reporters are not Darth Vader, always glum and looking at the dark side. They actually think things should be here, and they're here, and it bothers them. I think it's, and I guess that's what happened. I noticed that there were bodies piling up in the morgues in Santiago, Chile, in a Newsweek article I read, and I was like, what's going on here? Why are these bodies piling up? And there were some Americans that were in those bodies, so some of the bodies, and there was a lot of talk that the U.S. government was involved in toppling, you know, the government, Salvador Allende and Chile. He was elected. He obviously was also very, you know, leftist, and he wanted to, like all the candidates, wanted to nationalize, to some extent, the copper industry, their principal product. But there wasn't really a candidate who was against that, which is an unknown thing that people don't always discuss. Anyway, I couldn't understand what had happened, but more importantly, the bodies were upon them. I was just fascinated by it. How did we end up so, and clearly, and then Seymour Hersh wrote in September 8, 1974, an article on page one of the New York Times that there was an $8 to $10 million covert operation to destabilize the government of Allende. And I'm thinking to myself, this idealistic young fella, 21 years old, I'm like, well, wait a minute, wasn't that government elected by the public of Chile? And don't we say we're into democracy? Then we use that word all the time. Why are we doing that? And did we do it? But beyond that, if we did do it, what can the possible justification be? So I did a 200-page senior thesis called The U.S. Destabilization of Chile Under Allende, and at one point in the research, and this is crazy because I wasn't an expert on Latin America. I didn't speak Spanish. I mean, I was a kid. I was a senior in college doing this. But decided I had to come down. There were hearings about some of this, but I had the hearing material, but I wanted to meet some people. So I came down to Washington one day, and I met with Seymour Hersh, which, of course, was exciting. I had never met a Pulitzer Prize winner, and, of course, I thought what he had written was incredible. And he gave me, I think, approximately 3 minutes in the lobby of the New York Times Washington Bureau. But that was the first time I met a Pulitzer Prize winner. It was very exciting. And I was a kid, basically. But later that day, I went to the home of the former defense minister, the highest-ranking Chilean official from that government that had sought exile and come to the U.S., Orlando Letelier, Dr. Letelier. He was an economist. He was a former ambassador who had had several meetings with Henry Kissinger, but then he became the defense minister. And when the Pinochet government came in, he was put on a cold, barren rock down near Antarctica for a year and finally got asylum to the U.S. So I asked if I got contact with him and met him in his house. And I spent 2 hours with him, and he showed me secret cables in Spanish that had the U.S. naval ships off the coast right there in Santiago. And he was convinced, strongly convinced, that the U.S. was involved deeply with Pinochet, which we later found out, yes, they were. But he also said that there was a Chilean embassy break-in by the Watergate plumbers. He said he thought they were the Watergate. He wasn't sure. But at that moment, it hadn't come out yet. But yes, that's true. They did other burglaries, not just the Watergate. And so I was like, so I'm just this young guy, and I'm like, holy cow. So I'm leaving this meeting. This guy just told me what seems like secret information. It seems like jaw-dropping to me, and I'm clearly not fully equipped to deal with it. I'm just a student. But I go back to Delaware with this information, you know, trying to stay on the road, and I write the thesis. It comes out. I defend it, and I graduate from Delaware with that. But I then go to grad school, Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, in Massachusetts Avenue one day, and 8 blocks away, there's this massive explosion. and Letelier was assassinated, and assassins sent by the president of Chile, Pinochet, Augusto Pinochet, put a radio-detonated bomb under his car. That occurred on the same cul-de-sac in Bethesda where I met the man, Letelier, and I was like, I had never known anyone who was brutally murdered, but I also... We didn't know that instantly. I knew he was killed instantly. We heard sirens. I didn't know it was him. I find out within minutes or hours that he's been killed. But I think from that day on, you know, working for some think tank or working in the government somewhere or working on Capitol Hill, which I had done already as an intern during Watergate, that all seemed kind of boring to me. And I realized that information about those in power and the need for it was suddenly paramount. It didn't look like I had a neon sign, but I noticed I kept saying no to all the other jobs that I was looking into. And I ended up going to ABC News 3 years after Watergate and working at two networks for 11 years and then started the center. But it definitely changed, I say in the book, I mean, from that moment, I only know the reflection of decades later, but that meant that everything else was incidental except finding out this stuff, because I didn't get it at the time completely. But when I went to Hopkins, everyone wants to be a Secretary of State someday, or they want to work as a CEO of a multinational or whatever. But I think the only two journalists to ever come through there are Wolf Blitzer and me at SICE, and it's called SICE. And they'd be at cocktail reception. The thing that most interested me was the different layers of information. The government will say we respect the rights of this country to do whatever, diplomatically, publicly, including for the journalists and the public. Oh, yeah. But down here, of course, they're doing all kinds of undercover, covert type activities that theoretically might even be illegal, and it's okay because it's national security, and we then find out about it decades later. That's sort of what occurred in Chile. In fact, all the records about Chile to this day still have not come out 40 years later, which is unbelievable. We found out later that the head of torture, Dina, inside Chile, they killed 3,000 people in the days after the coup, including four Americans, which Rosie and I discovered we have something in common because he worked on that story at the New York Times, which I didn't mean to steal, but I didn't know till today on the walk here. Anyway, this was a huge issue, and we didn't find out until just a few years ago that the head of DINA in Chile, doing all the tortures, hundreds of thousands of people were tortured. That guy was on the CIA payroll, it turns out. And by the way, the U.S. government knew that Pinochet was conducting assassinations outside Chile with the potential also perhaps for the United States. So that whole story still is not known. There are many other things that are not known, but we never find out the truth in real time. It usually takes decades to emerge, and I could go through every major thing you've ever heard of in recent U.S. history, and I can probably tell you we don't know this or we don't know, because I've actually now tracked it closely. I won't get into the particulars. I'm talking too much. Anyway.
He's not talking too much.
No, but I am.
This is what you're here for. What personally... was it more painful for you when a story was killed by corporate interests, or was it more difficult for you when you faced personal risks, threats, or when the Russian oligarch sued you? What was the...
Yeah, that was fun.
Those are good
questions.
You can riff on each one of those.
Well, what was the first one again? No.
Personal safety.
Oh, personal safety. I was lucky. I wasn't like you, a war correspondent in Africa, various countries. I'm a mild-mannered guy. I haven't done any war zones, but I have had threats. We've had death threats. One time, Mike Wallace and Lowell Bergman and I were in the second poorest county in America, and the state troopers told us we should leave immediately because there was a death threat. And we all felt that it was bogus, and we ignored it, and we weren't killed. But that said, there are people. One time, a mafia guy in New Jersey threatened to throw me out the window, and he didn't seem like he was kidding. So I decided maybe the maybe the interview was over, and I decided I should leave. So I mean, and we and you know, I did a story about a campaign aide to Larry to Pat Buchanan when he had just won, I think, one of the primaries in one of the presidential campaigns, and one of the co-chairs of his campaign had taught white supremacist groups how to develop a militia capability, and we broke that story, and it was the number one news story in America. And I had a book out called The Buying of the President, and we had just broken the Lincoln bedroom scandal, also involving Clinton. But that story, I'm on radio shows already pre-planned by the publisher, and it so happened they had me on a militia station. I didn't know that. So they said, well, we have Charles Lewis here today. He's the one who just broke the story about our friend Larry Pratt, and the lines are lighting up. And my wife has a different last name than I did, and we had just been married, and her mother said, I'm so glad, sweetie, that you kept your name, and didn't. And she was worried. So that's the extent of my sleep, not too much.
The other threat, which is real, not only that you face, but when you're an investigative reporter, of lawsuits and corporate pressure. And
right.
Tell the story or tell us about what happened and how you were able to defend it with the Russian oligarchs and the cost of that, because it really speaks to the need for organizational support of investigative reporters. And there are risks journalists take. In this country, we're very fortunate where they're not targeted, but it's a rare circumstance. Chauncey Bailey was murdered here in Oakland 7 years mm-hmm. ago, a journalist. But around the world, journalists are maybe one of the few professions besides law enforcement or in the military that are actually targeted and eliminated.
Oh, yeah.
Because of their jobs. So, but talk about the situation with the Russian oligarchs. Tell us that story.
Yeah. You know, I start out, we try to just do the basic stuff, and then things happen. What can I say? All I wanted to do was do, since we had done at that point two Buying of the President books, tracking all the money behind the candidates before they're elected, so we actually know who their best friends are, because we're electing them too, and all of their agenda items for the next administration. I noticed that I was fascinated that George W. Bush had chosen Dick Cheney. You remember, he was the head of the selection committee and then suddenly is chosen. And I was fascinated because as I looked, he was the head of Halliburton, a multi-billion-dollar company, and he had never managed anything in his life. I mean, being a member of Congress is nice, and you have a little staff of like 15 people or 20 people. It's not the same as being a CEO. And then I could see him being chosen as vice president. He had a lot of government experience, former chief of staff to President Ford and things like that. But I couldn't figure out why he became a CEO of Halliburton. It was just fascinating to me because usually CEOs have some business background or they know something about the business that is that company's business that is some at least obvious, and it wasn't. And then I had an idea, which is what happens with investigative reporting. You have, I guess we'd call it a working hypothesis to make it sound scientific. Basically, it's an idea in your gut. Something's weird. It doesn't look right here. 2 and 2 does not equal 4. And so I wanted to see what happened here. Why was he chosen? So I said to my staff, I want you to check all of the lobbying in Washington and all of the campaign contributions and all of the federal government contracts that Halliburton received between 1990 and 95, before Cheney goes, and then during his time. So 5 years before, 5 years after. Everything doubled. Lobbying doubled under Cheney, contributions doubled, and their contracts in the billions doubled. And it just showed that what I suspected actually had occurred. He was chosen because he had a Rolodex in Washington. He knew everybody. Welcome to Washington. But it's just a good story. It was a very innocuous story. I mean, not a knock. It was a good story. I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. But we also had noticed, there's always the but, however, that gets you in trouble. So I'm glad we did it, but it was a nightmare. We found that one of the contracts was a $480 million Ex-Im Bank, this private public bank that they basically gave a loan to a company that no one had heard of or I hadn't heard of called Alpha Bank, and they specifically gave it to do business. This thing exists to help corporations do business overseas. Critics call it corporate welfare. business folks think it's terrific because it promotes business, whatever. I'm just telling you. So that's what they do. So the company was Tumen Oil in Siberia. So Cheney and Halliburton were doing business with an oil company in Siberia, which was really Halliburton, but because so that was intriguing to me. And so I had a guy who had won three Pulitzer Prizes on my staff, and I and another younger journalist, and I said, find out what this is all about beyond the contracts. Just look at this a minute. And we got all this additional information, and basically, the Secretary of State of the United States said, don't approve this loan. There's a problem with this company. And the President of the United States, Bill Clinton, overruled it and gave them the $480 million thing. So that was interesting to us. But the real point was, see how lobbying helps you? They just got $480 million, even though the Secretary of State didn't like it because of this mysterious company. And this company had been written about as having ties to nefarious groups, also known as organized crime, in Russia and other places. And it had been written about in hundreds of articles in Europe and the U.S. When we wrote what we wrote, it went like wildfire on the web because we had just broken all these other big stories, and this was all based on documents, and you know we had a record of credibility. Well, within hours, I got a phone call, and Akin Gump, one of the big fancy Washington law firms, 600 or 800 partners just there, I think, not to mention other offices, saying, if you don't take that off your website, we're going to sue you. And so I, of course, consulted with our libel attorney, and we decided, well, we have this information. We're standing by it. And so they bring what was known at the time as the biggest libel case in the United States in a quarter century. And they file it in all of all places, because Russian oligarchs are very litigious. They usually bring lawsuits in Europe, and people retract within minutes. And if they fight, they always generally can win, because the laws are different there than in the U.S. No oligarch had ever brought a libel case in the United States. They had done it in London. They have terrible libel laws that hurt journalists, so it wasn't surprising. But to do it in the U.S. was a little cheeky, and so for New York publishers and London publishers, everybody was watching if the oligarch thing was moving to the U.S. So it was a kind of a test case. Discovery was somewhere in the range of 100 to 150,000 documents. 20 people did depositions. I was under the lights, videotaped and all that, for 2 full days. And it's a long story. It was an ugly, nasty, rough affair. The cost of our defense, we had libel insurance, but we lost it because of this, but our insurer did cover us for this, which is a good thing, because the defense cost $4 million. The Russians spent something in the range of $8 to $10 million. That's their estimates by lawyers, including Akin Gump lawyers. And it was dismissed after 5 years. And the judge had been appointed by George W. Bush and had previously ruled in favor of something Bush and Cheney wanted. So I thought, as soon as it was assigned to this judge, I thought, uh-oh, we may have a problem here. So I was thrilled that it was dismissed, but what an ordeal. And my job as the head of the organization, I had a 40-person staff, 100-plus journalists on as a contract basis around the world. As you well know, your job is to maintain all that and keep a wall so they can do their job and deal with these kinds of problems. And we did 100 investigative reports, including 4 books, while we were being sued. And I would not let the staff know any of the details. I mean, I would tell them we're being sued, but I didn't want to mire them in all the emotional, exhaustion factor of what all was happening. Yeah, it was a mess. So we had 3 lawsuits altogether in my 15 years, but we were threatened 10 or 20 other times. But the 3 that were brought were dismissed. But the cost, even of the most simple one, cost $300,000 or $400,000. So yes, that's a problem. It's an occupational hazard.
And again, Chuck, at that point, was running an independent organization. We could probably keep going for quite a while if we asked about how corporate interest might handle threats like that, because there is a chilling effect. One of the areas that's most complicated in terms of investigating is often family court or judges, or and how getting underneath really what happens in the courtroom. Do you have any suggestions on how to do that? And the question came from someone in the audience who's deeply involved in it. But she really says, do you believe certain stories will never be told because of the power of the corruptors, quote, judges enjoy immunity, it's above the law. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I do. I mean, of the three branches of government we all learned about in civics class, the one branch that is the most virgin territory, that is to say fewer journalists have ever looked at it, is the judiciary. There's a great documentary that just came out in the last 2 years about family court, or
story of my life.
Where judges would just put people away forever, the documents would be sealed. So many cases across America, judges allow, usually it's major corporations that want to seal it up, but sometimes it's other records. So transparency with the courts is a significant problem. We investigated the chemical industry once, and there were hundreds upon hundreds of lawsuits where the chemical companies admitted their product was killing people. They didn't admit it. They signed it and gave the people money, and as a condition for the money, they had to be silent. And then they sealed the records. That is the way it works. And so, yes, a lot of these subjects, especially ones involving folks under 18, children, adolescents, that is for privacy reasons, but sometimes the court hides behind that fact. Yes, we don't want to violate anyone's privacy, but we're working on a big story right now about the courts and children ourselves, as a matter of fact. So, yes, I think that's an incredibly important subject. It's not looked at very much. And there are rights that are trammeled as we keep building up a law enforcement apparatus in this country. We're not spending a lot of extra money on public defenders and many other issues, and the level of transparency is inadequate, to put it mildly. So, yes, it's a problem.
Obviously, we haven't talked much about technology and the impact of technology and the Internet on all the things we're talking about, positive, credible information, disinformation. One of the questioners from the audience alludes to the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corp, just laid off hundreds of jobs and in their documentary unit. So is part of the future, as you see it, in terms of how information is disseminated, what do you see as the movement into mobile, I guess, and are you thinking about how people receive and use information in the age of evolving platforms and technology?
I mean, you and I both are, necessarily. 60% of the world's population gets their information on mobile phones, and it is growing further than that. It's not what we, at least in my generation, that would be your first thing to do, would be to have something this small to read and have, for more information, click here, for more information, click here. for a long story, it changes the dimension or the dynamic of truth-telling, I guess we'd say. But I also know that that's just reality, and you have to adapt. So what I think we all do is all of our stories and sites are adaptable to mobile technology, so people can see it on their phone if they want, but they can also see it on a big screen in high def that looks great, and they can also read it, and they can also read the documents. I know at the Center for Public Integrity and in my workshop, we post thousands of pages on the cloud, the omnipresent cloud up there, of documents and data that people can mine stuff themselves. We just put up 500 990 forms for foundations and nonprofits where they're getting funneled money by certain powerful folks. I can go into detail if you want, but I mean, all of that is technology, and it's great that you can. I started the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, now 185 journalists, almost 70 countries on 6 continents. The first time we discovered how significant technology is when we found out that the tobacco industry was smuggling 1/3 of their product. If you looked at World Health Organization records, you'd see that 1/3 of all manufactured cigarettes on planet Earth, according to the World Health Organization and other annual reports, they weren't being sold. Well, that doesn't make sense. Why would you manufacture? Well, of course, they were being sold on the black market. And the companies said they were shocked that this was happening, and they were conducting their own investigation. I'm exaggerating the responses of just a bit, but the basic point was we found that they were smuggling We had journalists on six continents reading all the documents that came through, thousands of pages. We sent the documents around the world without leaving our desk, and the woman in South America, a particular country, Colombia, found that the Spanish version said the word smuggle. They had made a sloppy mistake, and in one of the British American Tobacco documents it said smuggle. That would be the equivalent of a smoking gun. We put the 5,000-word article up on the web, and within 24 hours, actually 48 hours, there were criminal investigations launched in three countries on two continents, and the European Union announced their investigation, all from one 3,000 to 5,000-word article with links to actual inside tobacco documents. So that is the thrill of the technology. When you see that and you see the instant result you get and the fact that it's global instantly, it's pretty exciting.
One of the things we haven't talked about is the role of the source and how crucial they are in investigative reporting. And what we've seen also with the last few years of the Obama administration is a real attempt to chill investigative reporting by going after journalists who and revealing the issue of revealing their sources. Can you give that some context, Chuck, and not only the role of the source, but what you've seen evolving over your career?
Sure. I'll try to be efficient. I mean, clearly, all journalists need sources. That's sort of obvious. And the problem that's happening for journalists is in the old days, they would promise to protect the source. Now their news organization may not. And we've seen that with two or three news organizations where the reporter doesn't want to give up their notes and they do want to protect the source. And the publisher says, sorry, those notes belong to us, and they give it to the prosecutors. We saw that happen. I think it was Time magazine did that recently. And, of course, in my book, I have the ABC News thing. ABC News gave all of Walt Bogdanovich, a great reporter, three-time Pulitzer winner, gave all of his notes, including his expense account records, people he had lunch with, et cetera, to Philip Morris over the objections of Walt. Now, fortunately for Walt, he claims he never put any of that in a record, and he paid cash, and he made payphone calls, not credit card calls, because he knew he might be detected. But sources are extremely, you know, they're invaluable to journalists. The problem we have now is it's hard to find a source because of all the surveillance. I'm friends with some of the leading national security journalists, such as Jim Risen, and these days you have your GPS tracking device in your phone. In Washington, D.C., and in many cities, you have thousands of cameras. Government employees will always possibly know that the government may be reading their mail, their email, scraping the site daily. You can't go to the government office. You have to sign in. So how do you meet your source? Well, good luck. I mean, it's harder and harder. Of course, sources are seeing sources being prosecuted, 6 or 8 leakers have been prosecuted using the Espionage Act by President Obama, more than any president in U.S. history. There was never a debate or discussion about this in the 2008 campaign, I can tell you. It is a surprise to everyone that he has been so aggressive on that front. Sources now, getting a source is harder than ever. So I could talk much more about that, but I don't think we have time. Yeah.
Yeah, we've actually reached the point, this has moved very quickly, where we have time for one last question.
Okay.
And I'd like you very quickly, I mean, you described today your inspiration as a young man. What would you tell young journalists today who want to be investigative reporters about why this, what the future looks like and why they should do this?
Well, I'm not objective. I would tell them if they think that it would be good for the U.S. of A. and the world to have a future, they should become an investigative reporter because somebody has to watch the bastards, whoever they are. And I happen to think that really it's about the highest calling in the world. You get to find out information that no one else knows about and tell the world what is more noble than that. So to me, it's a no-brainer, but of course not everybody wants to do that.
Okay. Our thanks to Charles Lewis for talking to us today about his new book, 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. We also want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Robert Rosenthal, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.